Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting stories from around the world that help you learn and improve your American English skills. Today we will talk about the possibility of North and South Korean family reunions. Then we have some interesting news from Palestinians in the West Bank who have discovered a new energy source. It's time to listen and learn with VOA. North and South Korea are planning reunions for 200 family members. These families were forced apart after the two nations were created 70 years ago at the end of World War II. But with news of a possible North Korean missile test, politics could get in the way.
Activists have appealed to both countries to put aside political differences on the family reunions. Simgoo Sup is with the Inter-Korean Separated Family Association. She says, when it comes to the reunions of the separated families, we actually have to think of this as a basic human right. The reunion program has reconnected only a few of the 60,000 or more divided families. Official family reunions began 15 years ago. The program was suspended 10 years later, after North Korea fired artillery shells at a South Korean border island. The most recent reunions took place in 2014. A new film documentary features the reunions. Its filmmakers hope the two Koreas will pay more attention to the issue. The documentary shows how thousands of people were forced to leave their families during the Korean War. These men and women have since been unable to return home, even for a visit, because of the tensions between the two countries. The South Korean broadcaster TVN produced the documentary. The producers spoke with more than 100 separated family members. Most of them are now 70 to 80 years old. Because North Korea restricts travel and most communication with foreigners, many have not been in contact with their families since they were teenagers. The documentary shows the emotional pain they still feel. Lee Sung-rok, a TVN producer, said, "The main message of the documentary is the value of family." He said, "The key message that we wanted to deliver through this program is the value of family, putting aside political issues or policy-related issues." Lee Chung-joo took part in an official family reunion last year. During the Korean War, she came south to escape the fighting. After the war, she could not return home. She has not had any contact with her family since. Ms. Lee is now 80 years old. For her, the reunion was bittersweet. Before the event, she found out her brother and sister had already died. But at the reunion site, she met, for the first time, her two nephews, who live in the north. They told her about her family back home. "Contrary to my expectations, the family members in North Korea were having a good life, and I thought it was very good, and I found a lot of comfort in them," she said. South Korea looks at the joint family reunions as trust-building exercises. It says the reunions may help lead to more contacts and even future Korean unification. North Korea has not permitted the reunions as freely as South Korea. It has used them for propaganda purposes. Lee Chung-joo said she sensed that her nephews could not be honest during their reunion. She said they urged her to make a public statement praising North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for enabling the reunion to take place. There were a lot of journalists from North Korea who were trying to take photos of me, saying, "Hooray," or writing some thank you note to the North Korean leader. But I didn't respond, she said. In the past, activists organized inter-Korean family contacts and unofficial reunions, mostly in China, near the North Korean border. However, increased security has made that more difficult. The TVN documentary notes how China and Taiwan, and even formerly divided Germany, were able to organize family visits, even at times of heightened tensions. But in Korea, reunions remain a highly political issue.
You are listening to VOA, and we are coming to you from Washington. Rural communities in developing countries often have trouble finding dependable supplies of energy for cooking and lighting. But energy exists everywhere organic waste is breaking down. It is just a question of how to harness or make use of it. Jonathan Evans reports.
A Palestinian community in the West Bank has been successfully testing a device that turns food and animal waste into biogas. The village of Al-Aja has no running water or electric power. Solar panels provide energy from the sun, but not enough for cooking equipment. But as in many other parts of the world, villagers keep chickens, cows, or other animals. Recently, about 40 families started using portable devices that turn food and animal waste into methane gas. The European Union and the Perez Center for Peace provided money to pay for the devices. One villager says, "This is a very good machine. The machine provides us with 70 to 80% of the gas that we need for our household." An Israeli company, Home Biogas, designed the machine called a biodigester. Anaerobic bacteria are added to the device the first time it is used. The bacteria helps break down organic waste. The biodigester creates enough methane for cooking 3 meals a day. It also produces about 10 liters of liquid organic fertilizer. Biogas is smokeless and has no smell. In addition to cooking, biogas can be used to heat water and for lighting devices. A built-in, hand-powered grinder helps break down the solid parts in household waste. The home biogas system is designed for areas where the daily temperature does not drop below 15 degrees Celsius. The price is about $2,500, a somewhat pricey amount for most families. So communities must depend on aid from governments or private donors. But the designers note the system can also be useful in more wealthy communities that have organic waste which can be turned into clean energy. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to the program called As It Is, from the Voice of America in Washington. If you are hearing this only on the radio, you are missing a great learning experience. If possible, find us on the internet and download the program as a podcast. That way you can save the sound and also copy the written words we say. Then you can go back again and again and listen and read along. You might want to try speaking some of the words and sentences we say. That's why we come to you every day, to tell you interesting things and help you learn American English. Please remember to come back again tomorrow for another look at our world as it is.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. The Cameroonian government says that terrorism threatens large numbers of school children. Two bomb attacks killed 9 people last month in the town of Kolofata, near the border with Nigeria. At the same time, millions of children returned to school after a 3-month holiday. Cameroon has been working to make its school campuses safer. One of the most dangerous areas is along the border with Nigeria. Many families want to leave the dangerous border areas. 16-year-old Amidou Moussa was not able to return to school on time because of the threat of suicide bombings. His school is in the town of Mora on the border with Nigeria. He says he was not really worried during the holiday because his parents took him far away from the dangerous border zone to a safer area. Valentine Tame is president of the Teachers Association of Cameroon. He says many teachers are refusing to teach in areas along the border with Nigeria. He says he has told teachers to continue to work even in the border area.
We are appealing to those who have been posted there that that is Cameroon. You have to go there and do your work. But we are also more loudly telling government that they have a moral duty to take care of those teachers there.
Nza Amos Tara is a police spokesperson. He has talked with students, teachers, and parents about keeping young school children safe. He says if the population works with officials, terrorists will find it more difficult to carry out attacks. He warns that children should not trust strangers because they might be kidnappers, and that parents should walk to school with their young children. He also says that children must be taught about how to act around strangers.
Most of all, if they notice anything, they should report it immediately to the security officials they see. They are their friends and not their enemies.
Douala is the economic capital of Cameroon. There, school staff members search students and their bags with metal detectors before they can enter the school. Officials say they are doing all they can to avoid future attacks. Suzanne Ngume's children go to school in Douala. She says she agrees with the new security measures. This is just to protect our children because we want their safety in school, she said. And we want everybody to be relaxed and happy to be here. With all the heightened threats in town and wherever, we have to make sure that our children are safe. Last year, Cameroon closed 70 schools on its northern border with Nigeria's Borno State. More than 100,000 students were relocated to new schools. And that's the Education Report from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the election of Martin Van Buren as the 8th President of the United States. Van Buren had served as President Andrew Jackson's Secretary of State and later his Vice President. Jackson asked his political party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. The Whig Party was against him, but their opposition was divided. Van Buren won the election easily. Jackson stood beside Van Buren as the new president was sworn in at the Capitol building in Washington. Physically, the two men were very different. Jackson was tall, with long white hair that flowed back over his head. Jackson's health had been poor during the last few months he spent in the White House. He seemed tired. There was almost no color in his face. Van Buren was much shorter than Jackson and had much less hair. His eyes were brighter than those of the old man next to him. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren noted that he was the first American born after the Revolution to become President of the United States. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His family was Dutch. Van Buren said he felt he belonged to a later age. He called for more unity among Democrats of the North and South. He said better times were ahead for the country. Martin Van Buren had a poor education as a boy. He went to school only for a few years. His father was a farmer and hotel keeper at a small town in New York State. Politicians, including Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, had sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them and others, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended tenants and renters who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official and then a senator and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with. But she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with 4 sons.
And after that, he was known as quite charming among the ladies, as they said in those days.
Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. Mr. Silby says most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his political life and his social life separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. But he did not have a national reputation like Andrew Jackson had.
What he was known for and what got him into the vice presidency and then the presidency was that he was Jackson's right-hand man.
Van Buren had been president for just a few days when an economic crisis struck the country. The crisis had been building for months. It really began with the death of the Bank of the United States more than a year before. The bank had been so strong that it was able to control the economy throughout most of the country. It also helped control smaller state banks. It refused to accept the notes or paper money of these banks unless the state banks could exchange the paper for gold or silver money. President Jackson had opposed the Bank of the United States. He vetoed a bill that would have continued it. After the powerful bank closed, a number of new state banks opened. All of them produced large amounts of paper money, many times the amount they could exchange for gold or silver. Business speculators used much of this paper money to buy land from the government. These men bought the land, held it for a while, then sold it for more than they paid. The government soon found itself with millions of dollars of paper money of questionable value. To stop these activities, Jackson had ordered only gold or silver payments for government land. But many banks did not have enough gold to cover the paper notes. At the same time, American agriculture was having trouble. In 1835 and 1837, many crops failed. American traders had to import farm products from Europe, and they had to pay for them in gold or silver. In the spring of 1837, just as Martin Van Buren was taking office, the demand on banks for gold and silver grew too heavy. The banks stopped honoring their promises to exchange their paper money for gold. They said the suspension was just temporary, that it was necessary to stop for a while all payments in gold or silver. The crisis became worse. Many of the weaker state banks closed. Those that stayed open had almost no money to lend. Businessmen could not pay back money they owed the banks, and they could not get loans to keep their businesses open. Many factories closed. Great numbers of people were out of work, and prices rose higher and higher. Most people struggled to buy food and other necessities. The price of flour and meat doubled between 1835 and 1837. Even coal, the fuel people used to heat their homes, cost two times as much. Violence finally broke out at a protest meeting in New York City. Some in the crowd demanded action against the rich traders. About 1,000 people marched to a store, forced their way into it, and destroyed large amounts of flour and grain. Businessmen blamed the government for the economic depression. They said the biggest reason was a decision former President Jackson made. Jackson's order required the government to accept only gold or silver for government land. Opponents said the order had caused fear and mistrust. Even some of Jackson's strongest supporters said it should be lifted. They said the measure had done its job of ending land speculation. Now, they said, it was hurting the economy. Two of President Van Buren's closest advisors urged him to continue the order. Lifting it, they argued, would flood the federal government with worthless paper money. Van Buren was troubled. The federal government had already lost $9 million because of bank failures. The president wanted to make sure the government had enough money, and he wanted this money safe until needed. Yet he did not believe the federal government had the responsibility for ending the Depression. And historian Joel Silby says Van Buren did not believe the government had the right to interfere in any way with private business.
He said that over and over again, that the federal government doesn't have the power to do this.
Mr. Silby adds that Van Buren's political philosophy grew out of the beliefs of former President Thomas Jefferson. All of his life, Van Buren claimed to be a Jeffersonian Democrat.
That had very specific meaning to him. Limited government, freedom for people, meaning white males. He was an egalitarian within the limits of those years.
Van Buren also shared Jackson's suspicion of bankers. In general, he believed no group, neither the government nor the wealthy, should have too much power, not even to help the economy. So Van Buren decided to continue Jackson's order. No government land could be bought with paper money. The American economy got worse. The president called a special meeting of Congress. In a message to lawmakers, Van Buren said, "Overbanking and overtrading had caused the Depression." He proposed several steps to protect the government. One of them was for Congress to pass a law permitting the government to keep its own money in the Treasury. America's Treasury Department received money when it collected import taxes and sold land. It used this money to pay what the government owed. The Treasury did not, however, hold the money from the time it was collected to the time it was paid out. The Treasury put the money in private banks. President Van Buren wanted to end this custom. He wanted a law to let the Treasury keep government money in its own secure places. The Whigs criticized Van Buren for thinking only of protecting the federal government and not helping businessmen, farmers, and the states. Some Democrats, who believed strongly in states' rights, also opposed Van Buren's idea. All these opponents provided enough votes in Congress to defeat the proposal. Van Buren tried again the following year to get approval for an independent treasury. Again, the proposal was defeated. Finally, in June 1840, Congress passed a law enabling the Treasury Department to hold government money itself. Van Buren signed what was called the Independent Treasury Bill. But the economic depression continued. Martin Van Buren also faced an international challenge from a surprising place. The president's troubles with Canada will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.